West Africa is still struggling with the Ebola crisis. There have been over 17,000 suspected cases and more than 6,000 deaths. But the fight goes on. It seems never-ending, though a small ray of hope is on the horizon. The WHO reports that the number of new cases across the region has stabilised at about 150 per day. And on today's show, one of our guests has been in that fight and by God's grace has emerged unharmed. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. 6 months ago, the predictions of the number of people potentially dead by Christmas were overwhelming. Fortunately, we've not achieved those numbers. However, looking back to the very beginning, the BBC has this story of Ebola's patient zero, and it tells how the virus spread.
It began in December 2013 in Meliandu, a remote forest village in Guinea. 2-year-old Emile Wamuno infected his pregnant mother, Sia. Within days, they both died, as did his sister, Philomene, followed by their grandmother, Kumba. A nurse became infected, and the village midwife, who was treated at Gekadu Hospital. One of her close relatives travelled to the village of Dandu Pombo, taking the Ebola virus. 6 deaths followed here. Someone from Gekadu Hospital fell ill and was treated in Macenta, where a doctor became infected. After the doctor's funeral in Kisidugu, his 2 brothers died, along with 3 more people. The virus continued to spread, and on the 23rd of March, the World Health Organization declared an Ebola outbreak in Guinea. A week later, Liberia confirmed its first death. Soon it spread to the densely populated capital, Monrovia. Sierra Leone investigated, and on the 25th of May, confirmed its first case as the Ebola virus reached the capital, Freetown. A year after the first case, more than 5,000 people have lost their lives in what has become the world's worst Ebola outbreak.
And that number continues to rise. On today's show, we have a tasty treat that's perfect for the Christmas season and to stay in shape, a spot of exercise, along with 2 fascinating guests. But first, the news. In the headlines today, death toll for Ebola continues to rise and Ebola milestones met. The latest data released by the CDC indicates that Ebola cases in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia are estimated to have reached 17,000, with almost 11,000 confirmed cases and over 6,000 deaths. Mali has had 8 cases, with 6 confirmed dead. Other countries with Ebola included the United States, Nigeria, Senegal and Spain, where a total of 26 patients have been treated, resulting in 9 deaths. Intensive monitoring, early correction of electrolytes and fluid loss appear to be the key for survival. No specific treatment or vaccines have yet been identified, though a number of products are undergoing phase 1 trials. 2 important milestones have been reached in the fight against the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. By the end of November, the goal of the WHO was to reach the point where 70% of people who died of the disease were buried safely and 70% of those infected were quarantined. In the 3 affected countries, the safe burial goal has been reached, reflecting a major deviation from traditional Muslim burial customs. In Liberia and Guinea, the quarantine goal has also been reached. Sierra Leone still has some hot spots in the west of the country with hundreds of new cases still occurring each week. The good news, however, is that soon all 3 countries will have the capacity to catch up and keep pace with the new cases. The agency's new goal is now for 100% quarantine and safe burial in order to eliminate new cases. 20,000 personnel will be required to do surveillance and contact tracing. So the end is not in sight, at least not yet. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Our first guest today is Dr. Richard Hart, president of Loma Linda University. At the beginning of his medical career, Dr. Hart was stationed in Tanzania, Africa. He has pursued a tremendous vision for mission across the globe and is also president of Adventist Health International, or AHI for short. I asked him to explain the work of AHI.
Adventist Health International is an entity shared by multiple church organizations that actually owns it, that was born about 15 years ago now to help struggling mission hospitals get back on their feet. So we work exclusively with Adventist hospitals in developing countries, trying to work with them on governance and management, and then getting into equipment and supplies and personnel and so on to try to make them strong once again.
How many facilities is AHI working with, and where are they located?
We have about 15 facilities now throughout Africa. There's 10 or so throughout the Inter-American Division. We have requests from elsewhere, Nepal, India, Asia, that we're gradually taking on as we have the capacity to deal with them.
So AHI is growing and moving forward. It's a healthy organization?
It is a healthy organization. It's always stretched pretty thin because the needs are so great, but it's a good organization.
And how does funding come to AHI? How are you funded?
We have a number of donors. Adventist Health International has developed a donor list that raises around, we'll hit probably $1.4, $1.5 million this year that we're raising. These are people that have interest in trying to maintain the mission outreach, the health outreach of the church in developing countries. So it's primarily donors, some corporate giving, some church giving, but primarily coming from individual donors.
So that's a relatively small budget for a large number of clinics and hospitals around the world. Now, tell us about what work you're doing. We're talking about Ebola today, so tell us about the work that Adventist Health International is doing on the ground in West Africa. Let's start with Sierra Leone.
Well, about 4 years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago now, we were asked to take on two hospitals in the West Central African Union, one of them being what's called Waterloo Hospital, just outside of Freetown, Sierra Leone, and the other one, Cooper Adventist Hospital in Monrovia, Liberia. Both of these countries, of course, have gone through terrific civil wars over the past 20 years, finally ended about 7 or 8 years ago, and are trying to stabilize themselves. Sierra Leone had a large leprosy hospital for many years that was destroyed pretty much during the Civil War. So they've taken this new facility, which is really an office complex that called Waterloo, and converted it into a hospital. So we've been working with them to try to upgrade this facility, and have been working with both of these places for about, as I said, 3 to 4 years when the Ebola crisis hit. So we were there involved before, we didn't come as part of the crisis, we were there already.
Now, so tell us, how has Ebola affected Waterloo Hospital? What is happening there?
Well, Waterloo Hospital got hit particularly hard. They initially tried to deal with whatever came to the door, and that, of course, included some Ebola patients. It was hard to make the diagnosis initially. Some of our staff got exposed to Ebola, and so several of the staff at that hospital contracted Ebola and subsequently died from Ebola. That caused a fairly major concern there, of course. We closed the hospital for 3 weeks, waiting out the incubation period of Ebola to try to make sure none others were exposed, and then have reopened the hospital. At this point in time, the government of Sierra Leone has come along and said, we really want to work with you to use your hospital as an Ebola triage center. So right now we're in the process of working with the Sierra Leonean government to try to convert Waterloo Hospital on a temporary basis into a screening and treatment center for Ebola patients.
Now, I understand that Ebola is still somewhat out of control in Freetown, around the area that Waterloo Hospital is located.
Yes, I think that would be fair to say, although the last few weeks, the whole Ebola crisis seems to be tapering down somewhat. My understanding from some of these places that there are now a number of empty beds in the Ebola treatment centers. Before, they were crammed full and had no room for anybody, but now there is capacity in these treatment centers. So it appears that the epidemic is starting to peak, even though we'll have certainly cases for some time to come.
Now, having lost staff to the disease, there must be quite some fear amongst the staff in Waterloo Hospital. How are you able to deal with that?
There's been considerable fear. In fact, most of the hospitals in both of these countries closed because the staff were unwilling to come to work. So we have worked with our staff in both cases saying we will basically do a couple things. Number one, we'll give you operating support because no patients are paying for care anymore. The whole economy is flat in these countries, so patients aren't able to get income. The economy is shut down, so we can't get paid. So we're propping them up financially with AHI funds. Number two, that we would provide them with the necessary protective personal equipment. So we have been doing air shipments out of all the things that they need to adequately protect themselves. We've taken our staff through training so they know how to use these things. The biggest trick isn't caring for a known Ebola patient. The trick is, what do you do with all the patients who come who say they don't have Ebola, as far as you know, but they have an obstetric emergency, or they have a trauma, or they have malaria. There's so many other diseases that mimic the symptoms of Ebola that it's very difficult to know what is actually an Ebola case. And it's those who come in for other symptoms that are the most dangerous, because sometimes they end up being Ebola.
Right after the break, we're brewing up a seasonal sensation. But first, this.
Ouch! I think I got bit by a spider.
Oh, have a seat. I've got just the thing for you.
Oh, good. She'll have some high-powered drug for me, I'm sure.
Here, charcoal. It's a great remedy.
Charcoal? Are you kidding me?
No! You mix it with ground flaxseed, water, and then you make a poultice like this.
You're not using black magic on me.
You know, it's perfect for insect bites.
What does it do?
It takes away the pain, the swelling, and it absorbs the toxins. We'll just cover that with some plastic.
Right, the pain's already going away.
Really? There you go. It's used for poisoning all the time.
Well, have you ever used this before, or am I your guinea pig?
Lots of times before, Mr. Guinea Pig.
But won't it tattoo my skin?
No, because your skin's not broken. It's not going to leave a permanent mark.
Ah, well, thanks, Doc, for your black magic.
Use activated charcoal to treat toxins, to prevent swelling, bruising, and for pain. Doctor's orders. We're back. We're in the kitchen, and Phil's here. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, what are we doing today?
Well, around these holidays and around the cold weather, I love a fireplace and hot drink. And so I'm bringing wassail, which is one of my favorite things to drink in front of the fireplace. But with us, it's a little bit of a twist. We're going to make it a little bit healthier and take out some of the more traditional ingredients that we don't really want.
Okay. What's in it then? What's left?
So there's still a lot that's left. So this is 2 cups apple juice, 2 cups of cranberry juice, 2 cups of water, 1 cup of sugar, 8 whole cloves, 3 allspice berries, 1 tablespoon of ground ginger, 1/2 teaspoon of cardamom, 2 3-inch cinnamon sticks, and a whole clementine or an orange, juice of 2 lemons, and juice of 5 oranges. So there is a lot still in there, and it comes together as a really great drink that's great for parties, great for sitting around the house in front of the fire, anything to really kind of get that traditional holiday feel.
I think where I come from, this is called mulled wine.
Mulled wine, okay.
But of course this is made with apple juice, and it's got the wine look with the cranberry in there.
Well, this has actually been around for a little bit, so it's taken on a few names over time. So to start, why don't I have you juice our lemon and our orange, and I'm going to start putting everything into our pan here. Now this is our cranberry juice.
You know, it's really hard to find cranberry on its own, and so typically cranberry comes as a blend with apple juice or pear juice or one of those. So.
And I wanted to tell our viewers, because I assume that they're going to be asking, where's the apple juice?
Yeah.
And so it was hidden in here.
Hidden in the cranberry blend.
The other thing that's going to look, our sugar is going to look a little bit different. Now this is coconut sugar, and it's something that's been catching on more recently. And I wouldn't want anyone to think that it's just one of those fads that's going to come and go. Tell us a little bit about the coconut sugar.
Well, coconut palms are grown all around the world. This particular coconut sugar comes from Indonesia, but a lot of it is grown in the Philippines. And you can either use the coconut palm to grow coconuts, or you can cut the tree and get the sap, which creates the sugar. So now a lot of coconut palms are being converted into sugar because it's a bit of a fad, you know, that everyone will get on the wagon and then realize, well, actually it's kind of an unrefined sugar anyway. So you might think about buying it, trying it out. It has a slightly different flavor, but it is still sugar. So just perhaps less refined. However, you use fewer acres to get the same amount of sugar as you do with sugar cane.
Now this is one thing, when I think of the holidays, I think of this. And it was something that was taught to me from friends. And the first time that I tried it, I just loved it. So we put in the cloves. I've been stirring this up. And then you're going to put in the rest of our orange juice and lemon juice.
Whoa, that's a lot of citrus juice.
But it gives
gonna
it
be
that
fantastic.
Great flavor.
Yeah.
So it's not just an apple flavor. It's not just your hot cider or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
This just gives it a very spiced, fruity flavor, which I love.
Wow, I'm dying to try it.
Yeah, so basically you just cook that for an hour, and then you can serve it hot. I drink it however, because I enjoy it. And one thing I'll share with you, the name actually comes from a toast. It actually, in fact, the thought of toast was because they would put toast on top of it. And so we get our idea of a toast.
Really?
And wussel actually means be well. So they would hold up the wussel and they'd say,
wussel.
And it's great taste and aroma.
That is so good. Well, if you're around for the holidays, make some wussel. Wussel. Wussel, Phil.
Wussel.
Now be sure to treat wussel as an occasional treat, because all those spices and sugars are not going to give you a good night's sleep. No vaccine for Ebola has yet been found, but across the globe, scientists are scrambling to find one. Others in the UK and the US are working on the source of transmission, primates. Here's a report from CCTV.
As Ebola continues to spread in West Africa, the death toll keeps rising, with devastating effect. The World Health Organization says more than 5,000 people have now died from the virus. The search for a treatment is underway. Scientists at Plymouth University in England, along with American collaborators, are now focusing on preventing the transmission of Ebola from animals like fruit bats to humans.
Periodically, maybe they'll touch some fruit, saliva goes onto the fruit, it drops onto the floor, a gorilla picks it up or a chimpanzee, and it kills them. It's highly lethal in these great ape species. They then get taken back to a village, they are butchered, and now you have a potential outbreak of Ebola. So that's happened about just under half of all the outbreaks of Ebola have happened through that route of infection.
Scientists here have developed a vaccine using another easily spread virus called cytomegalovirus, or CMV. They want to treat gorillas with antigens from this and hope it could be a model for a similar Ebola vaccine. This would lower the risk of cross-species contamination, which Jarvis says has increased from urbanization and the popularity of bushmeat in Africa.
You're getting this continual driving together of humans and animal species in the wild. This has been promoted by deforestation. You're getting roads going in. You're getting actually the forestry companies hire hunters to now go out and hunt in the areas to bring in and feed their workers. So this is a problem that isn't going away and is actually getting worse.
The Ebola virus will continue to exist in some host species in the wild, but some scientists hope removing apes from the chain of transmission will reduce the future threat of the virus crossing over to humans.
It's great to see efforts being made towards prevention. We're talking to Dr. Hart, president of Adventist Health International, which has a hospital in Monrovia, the capital city of Liberia. This city has been a hotbed for Ebola, although things are beginning to cool down a little bit. I asked him how they've managed to keep the hospital staffed and operational when the city has been basically frozen financially.
When this crisis hit, the first question that came up is, should we close the hospital and protect our missionary staff by bringing them home? Dr. Gillian Seaton felt very strongly that this is the time the country needed us the most. It was not time to leave. And so in working with the church, we decided to keep the Monrovia Hospital, Cooper Memorial Hospital, open on the conditions that we would do several things. Number one, we'd give Gillian some help because it's hard to be a 24/7 surgeon in a place like this with all that was coming. We'd make this hospital a non-Ebola hospital. In other words, there are far more people dying from other causes than from Ebola. And so while all the emphasis was on trying to take care of Ebola patients, the real crisis in the country was all the hospitals had shut down because staff were afraid to come to work, and there was nobody taking care of the malaria cases, of the OB emergencies, the emergency C-sections, the trauma, and so on. So we agreed to make our hospital a non-Ebola hospital to take care of that patient load. Thirdly, that we would provide operating support, keep their payroll going. It's about $25,000 a month to support this hospital, that we would prop that up because the economy was flat and there was no way that patients could pay at all to keep the payroll going. And finally, that we would provide them with all the protective personal equipment, the PPEs as we call it, which is the necessary gowns and masks and gloves and so on to keep our hospital staff safe. So that's the road we went down in Monrovia, different than what we did in Sierra Leone, and did that very effectively for about 6 weeks. We brought down James Appel, Dr. James Appel from Chad, where he's been working for the past 10 years to work alongside Dr. Seaton, and they kept this hospital going as the only hospital in Monrovia for about 6 weeks until finally two of our staff there got Ebola as well. We think they probably contracted Ebola in the community, not in the hospital, because they go home at night, obviously, and then often get called upon to take care of people in the community, family members and others. And when that happened, and then particularly when one of our nurses got sick, we temporarily closed the hospital for a few weeks to let the staff kind of recover, and then have more recently reopened it again.
Now, in being the only hospital in a city of 1 million people that is dealing with non-Ebola cases and everyone is running scared, hospital means death and dying, they're staying out till they're very sick. So there must be a lot more dealing with death and dying even at the hospital door. How are you dealing with the psychological well-being of the staff there?
It's been tough. I mean, people in these places often get used to the pathos of human suffering and all that that means, of course. But when potentially every patient that comes to the door is infected with a potentially fatal illness, it changes the dynamics. We basically got to the point where the staff would triage through the car window before the patient would even get out of the car to try to decide whether this was an Ebola case or not. If it appeared to be Ebola, they would be referred on to the Ebola treatment center. If it looks like it wasn't, they'd bring them in. Sometimes, of course, we discover later that it was an Ebola case, even though the symptoms were masquerading themselves initially. So it was a very tough time for Dr. James and Jillian to manage during the period of time. OB emergencies, people dying shortly after they arrived. Everybody was afraid to come to hospitals. So even those with other diseases came very late. So the chances of helping them recover and survive became much trickier. Those are all the issues that we faced during this time in Monrovia.
Tell us, are there still ongoing needs, greater needs for provisions, supplies, for funding? How is AHI dealing with this? Because this must, with your small yearly budget, this must be really blowing the budget.
Yes, and we've just been the last couple of days back and forth with email. They are anticipating that they're going to need to be subsidized for another 6 months at least. So that's taking $25,000 a month just for salary subsidies. And then we're having to purchase the equipment, the PPEs, to send out there to try to protect our staff. We've also agreed to keep a second doctor there with Dr. Seaton. Right now, Dr. Greg Saunders, who worked in Nigeria for 10 years, another surgeon is back out there working with her, and will continue to cycle doctors out to try to keep the staff adequately covered. We have also agreed, I think understandably so, to give our staff a 15% hazard pay, because every staff working at that hospital is being expected to increase their risk of contracting Ebola by working with the patients that come. Even though we're a non-Ebola hospital, there are still a number of patients that come through that we later discover have Ebola. So those are all the challenges we have. Some of the issues there at Monrovia is our little hospital. It's only a 40-bed hospital, built a number of years ago. The staff and the patients share bathrooms. So it's things like that that make the risks greater. So we're hoping to actually do some physical upgrades shortly so that we can protect our staff that way as well.
Well, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. You've taught us a lot.
Thank you. And we'll continue to pray for our brothers and sisters in Liberia and Sierra Leone.
On the other side of the break, we have one of those physicians who worked at Cooper Hospital in Monrovia during the Ebola outbreak. But before that, consider this. Ebola frightens us because there is no cure, and more often than not, it results in death. In Jesus' day, the most feared disease was leprosy, and like Ebola, it's contagious, and then it required quarantine. The only way to avoid Ebola is to avoid direct contact with anyone infected with it. While it's not as contagious, leprosy was treated in the same way in Jesus' day. However, the big difference between Jesus and others was that he touched lepers. By doing so, he demonstrated God's power over disease. As the Son of God, he was not afraid. He was working under the authority of heaven, and as long as he was there, his Father's protection was over him. Believing in Jesus doesn't mean we'll never get sick. It just means that when we suffer, even a deadly disease, we can have confidence that we are in God's hand. So if you're sick, by God's grace, do all you can to improve your health habits, and then rest in the will of your loving Father. Jesus once said, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." So keep abiding. Welcome back, and it's time to move.
Let's move. Are you
ready?
Yeah,
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Are you pumped up?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
Are you off the
couch?
We're all
ready.
Let's go. All right.
Okay.
So what we're gonna do? Let's pretend like we're, you know, you're in a boxing gym, right?
Oh yeah.
And they get all hyped up because they're about to fight, right?
Yeah.
Almost like you know, you're going into it. That's what dynamic exercises are. Okay. So remember, just kind of do something like that where you're jumping around. Okay. Because today we're gonna be working those legs, but one partner is gonna be, all right, exercising, the other partner will be exercising, then you're gonna switch roles, all right? 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. What you need is a resistance band, all right? What I have the doc doing, you're gonna put this around, she's gonna put it around her waist, and as a partner, you're gonna provide the resistance, okay? She's gonna do a lateral lunge on that side. Give me 3 on that side. Yep, that leg, that right leg, stay straight.
I need to stay straight.
There it is, all the way down. Give me 2 more. Bend that knee, go. Yes, 1 more, all the way down. Perfect, and we're gonna switch, okay? You go for about 30 seconds, okay? Then your partner goes for about 30 seconds, a side lunge, okay? Here, back to the center. Back here, I'm gonna give you 1 more. We're all the way to the side and back, okay? So once you got 30 seconds, I got 30 seconds, I'm gonna go into a squat hold, and Doc is gonna go into jumping jacks for 30 seconds. Squat hold, 3, 2, and 1, go. So I'm working my quads, she's working her cardiovascular system, all right? As partners, you can keep them motivated, keep it going.
Yep.
Let's go, let's go.
Come
5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Now the roles change, she goes into a squat position. 3, 2, and 1, go. You can do this with anyone, with your kids, with your spouse. Just have fun. 5, 4, 3.
Are we nearly there yet?
And 1. There you go. All right. We got to make this fun. We're not going to stop. All right.
Okay.
You go right back into it again.
Whew.
To the side. 30 seconds. Don't give them a break. Go. Give me 3. 1. Yes. 2, and 3. Nice job. That's 30 seconds.
All right.
Switching sides. All right.
Let's hope he doesn't pull me over.
2 and 1. Go. 1. 2. As you can see, I'm breathing. 3. I'm going to give you 1 more for good luck. And 4. All right. I'm going to go into that squat hold. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I hope so. 3, 2, and 1. Go. 10, 9, 8, 7,
six, five, four, three, two, and one. I'm gonna go into jumping jacks in three, two, and one. Go. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight,
cat,
eight, 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 nine, and 10. Good job. That was called the setup. Have fun with it. This is what it's all about, having some fun, right? You're working those legs.
And the secret is you do the counting.
There it is. So right. We're working the legs. We're working the cardiovascular system, all right? That's what you want. Maximizing your time in a short window of opportunity. You have no excuses. 10 minutes, yep. 15 minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You can do it.
Absolutely.
You can. All right. So like everything comes to an end, you got to do it properly, right?
All right.
Okay.
So, we
what we're going to do today is just feet together, ankles together. And what I want you to do is come all the way down. Kind of do this little bounce, okay? And the more you bounce, the more you're going to try and reach and touch the floor, okay? And back up nice and slow. We're gonna take that right arm, put it across the body. Three, two, and one, switch. Three, two, and one, shake it out. All right, there you go. You got your warm up, you got your quick partner exercise, you got your cool down.
Yep.
And then.
And we've got counting, which we're gonna learn next time.
Yeah. Sure. I can count, I'm telling you, I can.
Yeah, all right.
Are midnight raids on the refrigerator spoiling your healthy eating plans? Three recent studies found a delicious way to control your hunger cravings: eating more whole grains. The studies all showed that people who eat more whole grains actually eat less because they feel fuller with less food. Regularly enjoying oatmeal, quinoa, and other whole grains will make you feel full more quickly, and it will keep the hunger pangs away. Adding whole grains to your daily diet is another ageless advantage.
And now for your questions. Someone called and asked, what supplements can I use for hypothyroidism? Well, it actually depends on why you have the hypothyroidism. If it's due to surgery, then I'm afraid thyroxin is the only answer. But if it's due to an autoimmune disease, such as Hashimoto's, then sometimes the immune response can be reduced by avoiding dairy or gluten or other triggers, and also by taking probiotics and other immune support agents. Someone else called and asked, how often should I eat tofu each week? Well, try to have a variety of legumes and soy of one kind or another every day. Well, legumes or soy, I should say, each day, whether it's tofu or some other way that you have your soy. Someone else emailed and said, how do you test for Asperger's syndrome and how is it treated? Well, Asperger's is an autism spectrum disorder. And so neuropsychological assessment is usually arranged by a psychiatrist or a school psychologist or a pediatrician. And treatment would include behavioural treatment, special education, and excellent care and support are all important. It's also wonderful if caregivers can learn what they can do to optimise the environment. Thank you for those questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text, or Facebook me. Now it's time to go not Christmas shopping, but nutrition shopping. Raspberries used to be a midsummer crop, but nowadays they're available all year round, so we really are rather spoiled. There are many different varieties and colours, but it seems that only the red raspberries are commercially available. A cup of fresh, raw raspberries contains only 65 calories, but it's loaded with phytonutrients. There are carotenoids, polyphenols, vitamins, and minerals. Animal research suggests antioxidant and anti-cancer effects. Full of fibre, they are a low glycemic food. See how beautiful they are. Each berry has about 100 drupelets. They can make almost any dessert look delicious. They go well in pies and pastries, jams, jellies and toppings. But in my opinion, they're best eaten raw. Bon appetit. Now meet Dr. James Appel, the young American physician that Dr. Hart mentioned has been working in Africa for 10 years. He volunteered to help Dr. Seaton at Cooper Hospital in Monrovia for the last 6 weeks. Now he's home in California with his wife and children for the birth of their fourth child. I asked him about his career since graduating from Loma Linda University Medical School.
I went and did a family practice residency at the Ventura County Medical Center. And after finishing that, I spent 3 months in France doing language study before heading over to Africa, where I've been for the last 10 years.
Wow. And so you've been working not in Liberia, have you? You've been working elsewhere.
Yeah, I've been spending the majority of the time in the Republic of Chad, although I've worked a little bit in Nigeria and Cameroon as well.
Now, what led you to go to Liberia recently?
Well, I'm in the midst of starting a new project in Chad. We've been at a district hospital for 7 years, and then at a surgery center in an urban setting for 3 years, and now we're in the process of moving to eastern Chad to help open up a hospital at the request of some of our Muslim friends out there. And so I didn't actually have any clinical duties at this point. So when I found out that the SDA Cooper Hospital in Monrovia was short-staffed and in desperate need of someone to help the surgeon who was there, I agreed to go and help for 6 weeks.
Now, there were a number of Ebola treatment centers in Monrovia, but Cooper was not one of them. You were trying to evaluate patients at the gate, so to speak. Tell us how about that screening process. How did you tell who had Ebola and who didn't, and what was the risk there?
Well, like you said, our goal was to actually treat the non-Ebola patient. We were not set up to handle Ebola cases. So one of my roles was to try and keep patients who had Ebola out of the hospital. But I had to do that without the ability to actually test them for Ebola. So what we did is we set up kind of a screening process outside the hospital where the security staff or the nurses would give me a call if there was a really sick patient. They'd have them wait in the car or the taxi. And I would go out and basically, just by observing them, by asking them a few questions, try and determine whether they were high risk for Ebola or not, which, as you know, since the early symptoms of Ebola are like many other diseases, it was quite challenging. And there were several times where, unfortunately, a few patients did slip in who we later felt were actually suspicious for Ebola. Then we had to try and find a way to evacuate them to an Ebola treatment center. It was an extremely stressful process because I felt like the staff was depending upon me to keep them safe from potential exposure to Ebola. And as well, that if some of our staff did get sick, I knew that the hospital would shut down. And the one place where people who didn't have Ebola could come get treatment would then be no longer available to them.
So this was the only treatment, non-Ebola treatment center left for the people of Monrovia?
Well, it was the only one that was consistently open during the whole epidemic. There were a couple others that would open and close, and you know, you weren't sure exactly if they were open or not. The ELWA hospital did remain open for the most of the time, although there was a short period of time when they were also closed. But still, for a population of over 1 million people, one tiny little hospital at best was trying to treat all the other patients, and it was a daunting task.
I'm sure it was, and I can only imagine the stress of having that weight of responsibility. Now, could you rely on what the family was telling you were the symptoms at that point?
That is what made it also difficult, is since I had to rely almost completely on history and minimal physical examination, yet at the same time, the family members knew that if they told me that certain symptoms that they knew were them, I would almost certainly refuse them entry to the hospital. They would lie often, and almost every time I asked the question, for example, if you have fever, vomiting, diarrhea, the answer was always no. And I could tell on certain patients it was obvious that they had been vomiting, had diarrhea, and then I checked their temperature and they would have fever. So they were definitely lying, and so that made it almost impossible really to tell. We got to the point where we were going mostly on kind of a gut feeling. And often we'd actually try and leave them in the car for 20 to 30 minutes because so many people would come right literally at the point of death where we would bring them into the hospital and they would die almost immediately. So towards the end, we were leaving them in the taxi. And if they made it past that 30-minute window, then we would consider letting them in. It was extremely difficult to determine who had Ebola and who didn't.
Now, you're not going back, but the other doctor that you were working with, she is going back into that situation. Is that right?
Yeah, Dr. Seaton, I believe, is already back. If not, she should be on her way in a few days. She is kind of there on a permanent mission position. I was just there to help out for those 6 weeks. I would love to have stayed for longer. I would love to go back. Circumstances at this point don't seem to make that possible. And my primary obligation is in the Republic of Chad.
Now, you, in your blog, which is online, you share a story of being exposed to Ebola. Tell us a little bit about that and what you can do to reduce your risk of actually contracting it.
Well, there were several times where I suspected that I was exposed to Ebola. The time when I really was the most worried, of course, it was unable to be confirmed since we didn't have any testing, but was a patient who came in and the family swore up and down that she hadn't been vomiting and diarrhea. And almost as soon as we got in to the room, she coded, which means she stopped breathing. So we were doing CPR on her and all kinds of IV lines and injections and things that were exposing us to her blood, which is the most contagious bodily fluid for Ebola. And then she started vomiting halfway through the resuscitation. And then the family said, oh, yeah, she's been vomiting now for a while. She's had diarrhea. They finally told us the truth after we had her in there and were working on her for a while. So fortunately, we always use universal precautions. While we weren't in full PPE or personal protective equipment, we were all wearing gloves and masks. And any time that we would, if we did get any kind of bodily fluids, we'd immediately wash it off with diluted chlorine water. And I feel like it's not just the amount of exposure that you get, but the duration of the exposure. So by quickly washing off any bodily fluids that happen to get on us, in a way, maybe we were minimizing our risk of exposure rather than if we had a PPE on and not known that some bodily fluids had snuck in or contaminated ourselves when we took the PPE off. So I think the main thing was we were using a lot of chlorine, a lot of bleach, and just universal precautions.
After the break, Dr. Appel has much more to share about working in the eye of the Ebola storm, so don't go away. Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone have been devastated by Ebola. Fortunately, Senegal and Nigeria were able to stop small Ebola outbreaks by close monitoring of contacts and rapid isolation of those with symptoms. Mali is now scrambling to do the same. Voice of America's Anne Look reports from Mali on what the country is doing to shut down the chain of transmission.
Every day, twice a day, the teams report back from around Bamako after checking just over 300 people, all of them linked to the Ghanaian imam who died of Ebola at this private clinic October 27th. Most of the contacts are cooperating, but not all.
You haven't been able to reach him? Didn't we tell him not to travel?
Coordinator Dr. Ramada Sako takes down his information. The teams are learning on the job.
If they don't come to us, we go to them. If we can figure out his village, we can see if there is a health post there and get him that way. Because this is a critical period. We don't want him to develop symptoms there.
Mali is playing catch-up. The circle of contacts widened rapidly in the 2 weeks that went by before health authorities here found out about the imam. Dr. Ibrahim Asose Fall of the WHO in Mali got the news from Guinea. By then, a nurse and a doctor who had treated the imam in Bamako were already sick. The clinic hadn't tested the imam. It's a cautionary tale for other countries in the region.
This never should have happened in a private or public clinic. Everyone knows the situation in Guinea. Had we known sooner, we could have prevented a certain number of contacts. It was late.
Mali is investigating the clinic and how the sick imam got past border police in Koromale. The town straddles the border. He was from the Ghanaian side. Health workers check everyone who comes in now. They keep records. They say their orders are to turn back anyone with a medical condition. This Malian man broke his arm in Conakry. Mali border officials will not let him cross. The Koramali Health Center is on alert. Dr. Drisa Berte says they watch for Ebola symptoms and sanitize between patients.
Everyone is afraid, but we're health workers, so we can't show it. We have to stay calm. If we show we're afraid, it would be panic.
An isolation unit is under construction at the border. They have a makeshift ambulance. But an infected person may not have symptoms yet when he crosses here. The whole country has to be vigilant.
Hopefully, Malians can be vigilant enough to prevent further spread beyond those already exposed. I asked Dr. Appel what the biggest health challenges are for Monrovians right now.
Well, certainly, even before the epidemic, the healthcare system was in shambles from the Civil War. Estimates were there were maybe 50 doctors in the whole country before Ebola hit, and many of those either fled or have died during the epidemic. While there have been some influx of doctors from international sources, those have mostly been for treating actual Ebola patients. So definitely, even if you have a non-Ebola problem, you still have really nowhere to go in Monrovia, and I'm sure it's much worse out in the rural areas. So it's while Ebola is definitely a big problem in that it is killing people, it's not killing nearly as many people as the non-Ebola diseases are that could be treated and prevented if the other hospitals were open.
And we're looking at things like, reading your blog, things like malaria. What other things are a big problem there?
Definitely malaria. In any of the tropical African countries, malaria is the big killer. But we saw a lot of obstetrics, complicated obstetrics. You know, when women had literally nowhere else to go when they had a complication, they came to us. So we were, you know, day and night doing high-risk OB.
And did you have enough resources at SDA Cooper for the people that were coming to you?
Yes, we did. Fortunately, we have a very good staff there at the hospital, and especially a nurse who is in charge of procuring medicines and things, and she would spend sometimes all day long running around town trying to find the IV fluids or the medications we needed. We also did get some support from Adventist Health International and other agencies who sent us especially things like gloves and personal protective equipment so we could keep ourselves protected. As you know, OB exposes you to a lot of bodily fluids, and not knowing if any of these women would have Ebola as well, we needed to protect ourselves during any delivery.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I understand that the fear of Ebola has caused quite significant delay in people coming for medical help, whether they have Ebola or not. What has that meant for you as a doctor, the team at the hospital?
It's made it extremely difficult and often discouraging because I've been in Africa for 10 years, but I've never seen this high percentage of mortality, of death. Because people were really literally waiting for the last minute to come in, so afraid to come to a hospital, afraid that they would catch Ebola, you know, if they didn't have Ebola. And so often they would come in and we would do our best, and it was just simply too late. We have children who would die because they would come in literally with no blood, their blood having been destroyed by the malaria parasite. Despite transfusions and appropriate malaria treatment, you know, they were just at the point of no return. We'd have many people come in with strokes, that it had them, you know, days or even weeks before, and finally come in, and it was just, you know, simply too late. So that was quite discouraging, and quite challenging because our lab also was under equipped to handle these kind of high acuity cases. We didn't have the ability to really do the tests we needed to provide the appropriate care, and so I think sometimes people died simply because we couldn't monitor them appropriately in order to know how to treat them the best possible.
So the statistics that we're seeing from the CDC of the number of deaths from Ebola is really only part of the story, because you're getting so many more deaths that are indirectly caused by the epidemic being in the country.
Certainly, and of course, I would say that over half of the Ebola deaths are probably going unreported because patients are dying at home without ever actually seeking medical care. And so those cases haven't been tested for Ebola, and often are probably not noted anywhere in any statistics. So certainly the deaths due to Ebola are probably at least twice what they're listed, not to mention, like you said, all the non-Ebola related deaths.
That's very sad. Now, if someone dies with Ebola in a treatment center, what happens to their body?
At first, it was quite difficult to know what to do because there's certain burial traditions, certain customs, and it was quite difficult to get people to give up those customs, especially the embalming of the body, the desire of the family to be in close contact with the dead person to say goodbye. The Muslims wanted to bury them within 24 hours and, you know, on their side facing Mecca. So get them to agree to burn the bodies, which is really the preferred method of disposing of the bodies to minimize the risk of contamination, was difficult. But I think at this point, pretty much everyone is aware and educated, and I think pretty much all the bodies are getting cremated. Certainly the ones that are coming out of the Ebola treatment units are being cremated.
Right. Now, the reason that I understand you are back in the United States is that your wife has just had a baby. And so congratulations.
Thank you.
Of course, you had the baby too. But and yes. So that's keeping you away from Africa just at this time. Where will you go back to when you return?
Well, we're already planning on going back to the Republic of Chad. You know, my wife and I met over there, and we've been there together for 10 years. So that's kind of home for us. And so as soon as we can get the newborn's papers in order, we're going to be heading back, probably in early January.
So you'll be taking a brand new baby back?
Well, it'll be 3 months old by that
three
time.
Months
but I guess
old.
Some people consider that brand new.
Yeah, and along with two other children, yes?
That's right. I have a 3.5-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Do you worry about the risks to their health in living in Africa? Does that worry you?
Well, certainly. We've actually lost a child to malaria. Miriam was a twin, and her twin brother died of malaria when he was 6 months old. But at the same time, we don't feel like... Well, how do I say this? How do you put the value on a life? You know, because if we were not over there in Chad, I know of hundreds, if not thousands, of children who would have died if we had not been there to take care of them. And so I have to ask myself, yeah, I could have kept my son here in the States and probably kept him alive, maybe. But at the same time, how many hundreds of Chadian kids would have died? How many lives is my son's life worth? And as a believer, I know that I'm going to see my son again and that this is just a temporary separation. So while we certainly don't want anything bad to happen to our children, we also know that this is what we are meant to do, and we place our lives in God's hand, and we'll do our best, of course, to fight against, prevent, and treat this malaria or whatever else it might be, put our children in harm. But while they may be at more risk for maybe some physical dangers over there, there's many other dangers besides just physical danger, and in that respect, Africa, I think, is a much better place to raise children.
Well, my condolences on your loss. I know it was some time ago, but thank you for everything you are doing for humanity. I know you're pouring yourself out to be where you are, have been called to minister. And I know with our viewers, I want to say thank you so much.
Thank you. It's our privilege to be doing what we're doing.
What a touching story of courage, faith, and commitment. The world could do with more men like Dr. Appel and like Dr. Hart, for that matter. If you want to know more about the work of Adventist Health International, then go to their website, ahiglobal.org, where you can also watch a video and read Dr. Appel's daily blog of his time in Monrovia. It's very raw and very real. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Health for Good. I'll see you next time.